Welcome back to Light on Conspiracies, the second part for subscribers only.
I'm here with my new friend, Field McConnell, who it's an extreme honor and joy to sit and listen to and learn from, because we are in an area where people from the inside, so-called whistleblowers, their knowledge is of extreme importance to the rest of us, for us to be able to better understand what is actually going on. And so in this second hour, I would very much like to go into especially a company called Circle that is very unknown to most of us, but it's extremely important. I would say extremely important to understand how it works, what it controls, and who's behind it. But also the interference and remote access to different vehicles, everything from planes to cars to vessels, whatever, this, I think, is a major danger. And in my research of false flag operations, the last year have been just packed with attacks by vehicles. And I didn't understand it for a long time until I started to see that these attacks with the vehicles is to try to make the vehicle the problem so that we will accept their solution. And the solution are these autonomous driverless cars. That is then the next step towards so-called smart cities, where everything will be digitally controlled and we will be in a digital pretty prison. So very recently, I've even seen that now this whole agenda with these driverless cars is being pushed forward very, very in media in Europe and in the States as well. Multiple countries are involved in developing these things. And I also, there was one thing that I reacted against was, why are there so many of these vans that are being used in the attack that are rental vans, rental cars? And just the day before yesterday, I saw in the news in the UK that now they're trying to restrict our possibilities to rent vehicles because for our safety and to save us from terrorism. So it's always this problem, reaction, solution. So my question to you, Field, is that I know that you have been talking about something called Boeing Uninterruptible Autopilot and what it can do to one of these big commercial flights and what it has been used to. Could you expand a little bit about that? Because I think that is very important to get a knowledge of as well.
Okay, I'm going to give you a little historical background and I'll get out of the history and get right into the BUAP quickly. In 1937, Germany developed a remote control aircraft that could be controlled by a mothership. In other words, a big bomber type aircraft would release a fighter type aircraft, and then they could, using a rudimentary technology, they could control the fighter type aircraft to go in dangerous places without risking humans. That was 1937, Germany. In 1943, the United States Air Force here in England, and I think it was from a RAF base called Fairfield. I'll have to research that. They had an aircraft called a QB-7, which was really a B-17 bomber, which was remotely controlled. But back then, the four-engine airplanes, whether they were German, British, American, the engines themselves were so complex, you really couldn't remotely control them until you got to cruise altitude. So I'll explain that on the third aircraft type, which I just mentioned, a QB-7, but that didn't work out too well. That was a Boeing B-17 that they modified in 43. In 1944, now here's where you really, your listeners will want to listen, because there's some real interesting history coming here. There was a U.S. Air Force aircraft called the B-24 Liberator, which just happens to be what my dad got shot down in, but we'll leave that for another discussion. The Kennedy family, John Kennedy, his father, Joe Kennedy Sr. Well, the eldest son in that family was Joe Kennedy Jr. In August, I think it was, of 1944, Joe Kennedy Jr. took off in a BQ-8, Bravo Quebec 8, which was a B-24 modified with a autopilot that could be remotely controlled. But just like with the B-17, They couldn't get the aircraft up in the air without humans. But on this day in August of 1944, a BQ-8 loaded with 21,600 pounds of Torpax, T-O-R-P-A-X, explosive, took off from England, and it was going to go across the channel and attack the buzz bomb bases in France that were operated by the Germans. And it had 21,600 pounds of high explosive. And so the reason that Joe Kennedy Jr. was in that aircraft was because in America, at least, and I know the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia, they love to get favored, F-A-V-O-R-E-D, favored sons into glamorous operations to prepare them for political service after the war. And such was the case with Joe Kennedy Jr. Why should a Navy guy be flying an Air Force airplane? That was the first area where I got interested in this, and I've resolved it. Anyway, the airplane took off, and Joe Kennedy Jr. and his co-pilot were the only two men on the airplane. They got it up to altitude while still over English countryside, and then they had a chase plane, and it was an RAF Mosquito chase plane with a guy in there with a Bell and Howell camera taking a picture of the crew bailing out of the drone bomber. And the protocol between the bomber crew and the Mosquito crew was just so the cameraman would know when to film. He wanted the bomber crew to say some series of words, and I don't know, and I don't think anyone knows what those series of words were, but whenever I talk about this, which is not frequent, I say one potato, two potato, three potatoes. But here's what happens. You have the bomber all set up, and it's on autopilot going to destroy the buzz bomb base in France, and the crew is ready to bail out. And so before they bail out, they send a signal to the RAF Mosquito to get the camera going, and the agreement was one potato, two potato, three potatoes, bail out. That didn't happen. Here's what happened. They're going like this. You hear one potato, two potatoes, boom. And the airplane was destroyed. 21,600 pounds of explosives destroyed Joe Kennedy's life and destroyed Joe Kennedy's political aspirations. Now, what's really interesting is who was in the RAF Mosquito. And I'm sure that many of your listeners simply will not believe this until they research it and find it to be true. On that day in history, the President of the United States was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, commonly called FDR. His son, Elliot Roosevelt, was a U.S. Air Force pilot in an RAF Mosquito. So you got the president's son. It's just amazing. I mean, all of us people in the world need to learn the true history of the world. But you got FDR's son supposedly videotaping Joe Kennedy's bailout or egress from the bomber. That's not what happened. One potato, two potato, boom. What Elliot Roosevelt really filmed was the death of Joe Kennedy Jr. And I just since we're sort of in World War II and we're sort of talking about killing political people, on the mainland of Germany, the biggest name in American army potency was General George S. Patton. Okay, well, the war in, I believe the fighting in Europe was done in May of 45, and in December of 45, George Patton was still there. And he went for a ride in a 1939 Cadillac to go pheasant hunting. And his talk about remote control, his 1939 Cadillac was going down a country highway, and a U.S. Army 6x truck, they're called 6x because they have six drive wheels, 6x6. They're 2.5-ton trucks. They're still in operation today all over the Russian Federation, the former Soviet states. In the United States, they're collector items. Okay, this great big truck intentionally drives into Patton's Cadillac and basically drives over a portion of it And George Patton was in the back. And when the collision occurred, he leaned forward. The impact drove him forward into the glass divider, and it broke his neck. But it didn't kill him. So he was in the hospital. I think the accident wasn't an accident. I think it happened on the 12th of December of 45. He died in the hospital on the 21st of December of 45. And he didn't die of his injuries. He died because the people running the United States of America could not have military heroes come back and run in the election of 1948. Mm-hmm. They couldn't have a Democrat come back. They couldn't have a Republican come back. They had to kill these guys where they were and make it look like a combat loss or an accident. Go ahead.
Can I ask you, you say one potato, two potato, boom. What are you suggesting, that that it was actually remotely ignited, the explosives, yeah, from the follow plane, the mosquito? Yeah.
They knew that the crew was going to leave the aircraft on the third potato. So when the crew said two potatoes, they detonated the explosive. And how could that be done? Very easily. All you have to do is have some type of electrical device in the explosive so that when the microphone is triggered or a microphone-like device is triggered, it sends an electronic arc across the receiver and it detonates. So the people in the RAF Mosquito, there may have been two of them, but Elliot Roosevelt was there for sure. And they blew up the aircraft, which was a BQ-8, and they killed Joe Kennedy Jr. And once again, this is stuff, some of the facts are clearly recorded correctly. But, you know, this is sort of like the rest of the story, what really happened. And that's what really happened. The election of 1948 was protected from somewhat legitimate heroes who, you know, the military, the United States of America, most of the time I've been alive, we have great respect for people who've done very good jobs in the military. And these two guys would have been thought of as having, well, I don't think anybody can say that George Patton didn't do a very good job. I think he, you know, as ugly as war is, and I'm more anti-war than anybody you've met, I hope, and unless you are equally anti-war. But if you're going to have a war, as regrettable as that is, you better be good at it. And I think George Patton was very good. I don't think Joe Kennedy was good. I think he was just a political animal that they were trying to prepare for political service. But that's not what you ask about. What you ask about was remote control of vehicles. And in this world we're living in today, vessels on the sea can be remotely controlled. It doesn't matter if they're merchant vessels or if they're military combatant vessels, they can be controlled remotely. Every single airliner in the world that is, I'm going to say two terms, glass cockpit, which means instead of old analog instruments where you have dials and luminescent pointers, you have it looks like a video game up in the front of airliners today. There's five basic airliner producers, Sukhoi in Russia, and they had an accident in May of 2012 where I talked to Putin through a cutout. I didn't talk directly, but it went directly to him. So you got Sukhoi in Russia, you got Bombardier in Canada, you got Embraer in Brazil, you got Airbus, which is the European consortium headquartered in France, and then you've got Boeing in the United States. All five of those airliner producers are producing aircraft that are glass cockpit and fly-by-wire. And what fly-by-wire means is the signals to the control devices, the ailerons, the elevators, the rudder, it's all done electronically. And it's meant to be not only safer, but also much more efficient. And those are good things. The bad thing, the ugly side of this, is if the electronic components of these control mechanisms for the control of the aircraft, the flight controls, that can be, let's back up. They created something called a Boeing Honeywell Uninterruptible Autopilot, and I can share this with you. I've got the academics on it going back to 1953, the patent history from 1953 to 2013. And that the creation of the Boeing Honeywell uninterruptible autopilot was originally a military device. And then when there were hijackings of U.S. airliners in the 60s and 70s, the airline industry, the government, and the military said, well, why don't we put these uninterruptible autopilots in aircraft? And that way, if humans want to attack an aircraft, they can't do it because the control of the aircraft can go to a benign entity, which would be the uninterruptible autopilot. And then the people controlling it remotely could take that aircraft. Initially, there were 108 airports around the world that could accept autonomous airliners. Now it's just about basically the technology is so good that any airport that has an ILS system, which means instrument landing system, can accept an airliner. So what they've done is they've taken a very good device that was created and conceptualized and manufactured and installed to prevent hijackings. Well, nowadays in the post 9/11 world, because of 9/11, all the cockpit doors were armored and made supposedly. I mean, the story is you can't break into it. And that may or may not be true. But because humans can no longer hijack airliners, and the devices in every single airliner, well, then these evil people that are trying to destroy countries around the world, and you just mentioned it, smart cities? No, that'd be dumb cities, dumb enough to believe what their governments tell them they need. We don't need anything from the government. They should be working for us, and we will tell them what we need from them. But that's not how the world works currently. They tell us, well, here's the problem, but we're going to save you with this solution. So just do it. And you know what? We don't need to just do it. But with the Boeing uninterruptible autopilot or the Airbus uninterruptible autopilot, now every airliner that's flying today that has both glass cockpit and fly-by-wire, the control of the aircraft can be remotely manipulated through the uninterruptible autopilot. Now the engines, the power, the speed, or the lack of power, the lack of speed, that can be controlled by a system called FADEC. I'm going to spell it first, then I'm going to explain it, then I'm going to ask you a question. And don't worry, you will get the question right. Even though you don't have any idea what I'm going to ask you, there's no doubt you're going to get this right. So don't worry about the question. FADEC stands for Full Authority Digital Engine Control. It's in all the airliners. It's in most of the U.S. Navy ships after they started modifying them in the year 2000. And so what we now have is we have all the airliners and all the ships that can be controlled or steered, and the power can be increased, decreased, or shut off remotely. Okay, now I'm going to explain, that's very important your listeners and the good and bad people around the world understand FADEC. It is Full Authority, I'm going to say that again for emphasis, Full Authority Digital Engine Control. Okay, put yourself in the position of being an airline captain, and your job is to have full authority over not only the aircraft itself, but everything and everybody in the aircraft. Here's my question to you. Is it academically possible for the human crew to have full authority if the hardware already has full authority? Yeah, you got the right answer. It's impossible. What that means is it's illegal for airline captains to operate their aircraft because they do not have full control of it. Now, how many times has this been used? Let me count them. Four airplanes on 9/11, United 175, United 93, American 11, American 77. Since 9/11, there's been 15 aircraft that have been interrupted and remotely guided to, only in one case was it not fatal, and I might get the year wrong, but I think it was February of 2007, there was a British Airways Boeing 777 that was landing at Heathrow, and the call sign was Speedbird 38. Now, its engines were shut down. The official story is they had ice in the fuel. Well, you don't get ice in the fuel, you know, 500 feet above the runway. It doesn't happen. And there's also de-icing mechanisms in the aircraft. So that was what they blamed the loss of thrust on icing. And it is possible for icing to result in loss of thrust, but typically not down very, very low. On that day in history, Speedbird 38 had both of its engines fail very close to touchdown at Heathrow. And I don't very often say incredibly complimentary things about pilots, but I'd like to meet the captain of Flight 38 someday, because what he did with his own judgment, and he had to do it immediately, he did something that saved the lives of probably everybody on that airplane. The co-pilot was flying the aircraft. What the captain did was, he didn't do the typical captain thing, saying, oh, we have a problem, I better fly because I'm better. No, he knew that that co-pilot was doing a good job. Plus, the co-pilot had the feel of the airplane, you know? And so he let the co-pilot finish the landing. Now, they destroyed the aircraft. They didn't kill one person. That was one of the flights. I've written about 15 flights in detail that were remotely destroyed. In this case, they didn't kill a person. They destroyed the aircraft. Some of the other airplanes that your listeners would be familiar with, depending on where they live, would be Turkish 1951 at Amsterdam, Air France 447 that left Rio de Janeiro destined for Paris, and at the deepest part of the ocean and at the worst weather between Rio de Janeiro and Paris, the aircraft tried to top a thunderstorm with the two co-pilots flying the aircraft and the captain back in the crew rest facility. And I won't tell you what the captain was doing, but I will tell you he was not resting and he was not alone. Just leave it at that, and I'll finish the story in Texas when we meet. But these two very inexperienced co-pilots got in a situation where their aircraft was attacked technology-wise, and the Airbus aircraft, and I've flown them both for Northwest Airlines in the U.S. and for Air Astana in Kazakhstan, they're wonderful aircraft. The technology is superb. A human cannot make a mistake in an Airbus aircraft if everything's working right. Okay, that's a big if. All that stuff can be remotely shut down electronically. That's what happened with Air France 447. And, you know, several hundred people died. There were several factors, but it was a remote attack. Let's move up to another attack that everyone that listens to you would be aware of, MH370. And this is going to touch on Serco, by the way. MH370 took off from Kuala Lumpur, bound for Beijing. It had 20 very important passengers. They were Freescale software engineers who had come up with a patented device. Four of those 20 engineers owned 20% of the patent. The fifth owner of the fifth slice was a Rothschild. But the patent had not been approved on the 8th of March of 2014 when the aircraft allegedly was lost, which it never was lost, not for one nanosecond. But let's pretend like it was lost. So anyway, now you got a patent for a world-changing device, and four of the people on the patent are lost, and Rothschild's the only one left. Rothschild gained control of the patent. He sold his control for $3 billion. Rothschild made $3 billion on the loss of Malaysia 370. But it gets more sinister because Malaysia 370 was never lost. I would love to do a movie. I could do it right now. If you and I were in a city like Amsterdam where there's a simulator, we could go around a simulator. We could hire a camera guy, two camera guys with microphones, and you and I could sit in the pilot seats, and I'd show you exactly what happened to Malaysia 370. It took off, it went on course, it got to altitude, it got to cruise speed, and it went to an intersection called BITOD, BITOD intersection. That's at the confluence of the Vietnamese, Singapore, and Malaysian airspace. So if you take a circle and cut three equal shaped triangles of pie. At Baitod, you've got Vietnamese, Singapore, and Malaysia air traffic controllers that may or may not be in control of the aircraft. It's called a cone of confusion. Right there at that specific place, MH370 did a left 180-degree turn and appeared to be returning to Kuala Lumpur. And so the controllers, it doesn't matter, Vietnam, Singapore, Malaysia, they all start wondering what's going on with this aircraft. So they tried to talk to it. And the crew could not talk. Okay, the Boeing uninterruptible autopilot is a device that's on all these airliners. But when it's remotely triggered, two of the things it does instantly is, so all you do is you pull the trigger or press the switch to energize the autopilot. All of the communications devices, which would be VHF radios, HF radios, a device called an ACARS, which is a aviation crew and reporting system, activity reporting system. It's ACARS. People can Google it or search engine it. As soon as the autopilot's triggered remotely, the crew cannot talk. Okay, the transponder gets shut down. That's the device that tells the ground controllers what the aircraft's doing and who the aircraft is. Here comes something really sinister, so I hope you're ready for some extreme evil. There's a device on those airplanes called an ATI, air tranquilizer injector, which introduces calming gas into the cabin of the aircraft so that the idea, it's a good idea gone rogue. The idea was if there's a human hijacking and the flight attendants and the passengers are nervous, you can calm them down for their own protection. Okay, I want to use alcohol as a metaphor because none of your listeners, neither you nor I, totally understand how gas can affect human bodies. But so let's go to alcohol. This is about 12 ounces of water. But if it was 1 ounce of alcohol, and you and I, regardless of what our personal lifestyle is or our history, if you and I took 1 ounce of alcohol and drank it and stayed on camera, nobody would see any change in our behavior for probably 15 minutes or more. Okay, if you or I took 6 ounces of alcohol and drank it, people would see changes in behavior quicker. And one of the changes would be slurring of speech. Okay, now let's go to the extreme. 16 ounces of pure alcohol. If you and I, or you or I, on camera, drank six, I couldn't do it. Hopefully you couldn't either. I know neither one of us would want to. But if we did, if we ingested 16 ounces of pure alcohol, we might just be dead. It's called alcohol poisoning. The same is true of the gas released in the cabin of all these airliners. You can either give them enough gas to calm them down, and think about a dentist putting you to sleep in a dentist chair, or surgery with anesthesiology, or you can have enough gas to make you go to sleep, or you can have enough gas to be killed. I'm expressing my opinion right now, but I've been expressing this one for 3 years and 6 months. From the day Malaysia 370 was attacked, I have said that the ATI caused the death of everyone on the aircraft. Now, the aircraft was initially attacked by a private corporation, I believe. And if I'm wrong, I invite Serco, S-E-R-C-O, to tell me I'm wrong and for them to send me conclusive proof of who attacked it at Baitod. I think it was Serco. I could be wrong. But then it was attacked a second time by the United States military, I believe, because you cannot make this type of fiction up. There was a multinational flying exercise, two of them actually, one called Cobra Gold and one called Cope Tiger. They were involving the militaries of Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, the United States of America, and maybe one or two other nations. And it was an aviation exercise that had AWACS. Now, AWACS are those great big airplanes that have a radar dish on top of them. NATO has AWACS, built their Airbus AWACS. The United States Air Force has E-3B Sentry AWACS, both Singapore and Malaysia have AWACS, which are built by Grumman. So there were at least three nations, and I don't know if Thailand has AWACS or not, doesn't matter. You got three nations with AWACS out there flying in this airspace. All three of those nations would have seen the airplane turn around and go back towards Kuala Lumpur. Now, the facts are going to stop and my opinion is going to take over. It's my opinion that anybody from any nation that saw that airplane turn around would just get on a commercial channel, a government channel, air traffic control channel, and say, what's going on with MH370? And the answer would be, we don't have a clue. We're not talking to them. Well, I can speak as a U.S. Air Force veteran that if the United States Air Force saw an airplane that was potentially remotely hijacked electronically, and they either got permission quickly or they went out on a limb and did the right thing without protection, they could re-hijack it electrically and shut the back door. Let me just say that again. They could hijack it electronically through the BUAP and shut the back door on the software. In other words, they could prevent anybody else from hijacking it. So when it was taken the second time, and once again, it's an opinion, but it's an easily proven fact, and it's impossible to disprove this. There is no way anybody can say this didn't happen. Impossible. I believe the United States Air Force AWACS, with permission or without permission, took control of that aircraft to make sure it was landed safely, thinking they could save the aircraft and they could save the humans. When it was landed at Diego Garcia at 06:51 in the morning on the 8th of March of 2014, it was taxied into a hangar, which is an interesting proposition already, but I'll leave that for another face-to-face meeting. But the hangar that it was taxied into had Faraday cage type technology, which means that overhead satellites could not see that aircraft. They couldn't look, and it was a fabric hangar, but it had metal mesh that protected it from electronic intrusion. When the engines were shut down at 06:51, I'm sure that the people on the ground, and they would have been at least from three nations, they would have been from the U.S. and the U.K., which operate the military base, and the Philippines. There's a lot of Filipinos that work in what some judgmental people would say are meaningless jobs. Okay, it's a meaningless job. If you're a billionaire and your toilet's plugged up, are you going to clean it? No, a plumber's going to clean it, and it's not a meaningless job. Same thing over on Diego Garcia. When the airplane went into the hangar and the engines were shut down and the parking brake was set electronically, I'm sure that people there thought the crew is going to go to the, it's called door 1L, most forward door on the left side where people embark and disembark passenger airliners. I am absolutely confident that the witnesses on the ground would have expected to see that there's a red strip on the window that says don't open the door from the outside because the evacuation slides are armed. When they take that strip down, it means, and usually they put a finger or thumb, they'll stick a thumb in there and say, go ahead, you can open it safely. If you open it when it's not safe, you're going to get blown down by this great big raft and escape slide. But the door didn't open. And so when they got inside that aircraft, it's my opinion, and I've been saying this for 3.5 years without a rebuttal, I believe that all 239 people were dead. Now that created a huge diplomatic problem for not only the United States of America, but also the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom owns Diego Garcia. The United States of America leases it. They've got an airplane with 239 dead people. And how do you explain that? Well, two weeks to the day after it went down, I got a call from Malaysia, from government and Malaysia Airline Systems people saying, Field, did you put out a YouTube called Boeing Uninterruptible Autopilot? And I answered yes, even though I didn't put it out, someone else did it, but it was all about me and about my true history. And they invited me to come to Kuala Lumpur and explain what happened to their airplane. And I did. So what we have now today, you asked me a question about remoting of vehicles, and you implied that one of the byproducts of remoting vehicles would be fear that would trigger a reaction or a protection. Do you remember a couple times recently, once in China, once, I think it was in Spain, but it was somewhere in Europe where a train came into a station going way too fast to negotiate the quantity. It should have stopped, but it was being remotely controlled, and it wasn't going to stop, and it was going so fast it actually leaned to the right on a left-hand curve, and it derailed itself. So, and this happened in New York City, now that I think about it. So what these remotely controlled vehicles, and let me just count all the remotely controlled vehicles that are out there today. Every airliner that's fly-by-wire and FADEC, merchant vessels and military combatant vessels, trains, over-the-road trucks, and privately owned cars, or as you say, rental vans. They can all be used as weapons. And who are the victims of those modernized weapons? We the people, 7 billion people. We're all being hurt or threatened or scared. The greatest tool that the bad people have, the evil parties, their greatest tool is deception and fear. And so what we have to do is try to figure out what they're doing and then tell our fellow humans, don't be afraid of them, we will defeat them. So we've talked about cars, trucks, trains, ships, and airplanes. So I think I've answered your question about BUAP, and the people that created the BUAP is Honeywell in the United States and British Aerospace in the United Kingdom, but the people that are deploying it, I believe, is Serco in the United Kingdom, which just so happens to control the entire military of the United States of America. That's my answer.
Short and concise.
Yes, I'm very laconic. A man of few words.
Listen, Field, the latest attack, which I claim is a false flag in Charlottesville, which totally to get a civil war going and destroy the U.S. from the inside. There is one thing on this car that is attacking the crowd. There, I've gone into great detail. There's at least two different vehicles with the same number plates or license plate that is involved in this whole thing. Two are more or less identical Dodge Challengers, but they got the same license number, and it's GBF1111. And then the mother of this young man that is accused of having done it, her car, which is not a Dodge, but a Hyundai, is GBF1122. And in these false flags, they have a tendency to involve psyops as well, and also leave clues about upcoming events. The reason I say this is GBF 1111 and GBF 1122. I mean, what are the chances that two license plates in the same family will have almost identical numbers when they're not even the same make? So this GBF, I've looked into it, and one of these planes that disappeared, I think it's the MH340. There is a company called GBF Satellites that were the ones that that showed how this plane had been, the route of this plane. So I'm asking, can you see any reason why they would leave that clue? And if so, does 1111, could that be a date like the 11th of November, and 1122, that's the death date of the JFK? Can you see any kind of dots that are connected there, or is this just wild speculations?
No, it's not. No, it's not wild speculation. It's accurate. Now, I have not heard about GVF and the satellite, but I believe you. I mean, I believe you completely when you say that, and you can believe me that 10 minutes after we say goodbye, I'll be an expert on it, because not only will I go research it, but our group, Able Danger, has some fantastically skilled people around the world. So it's like, we're like the British Empire. We never sleep. The sun never sets on us, because we have passionate individuals around the world in many, many time zones. But let me tell you something about the Dodge Challengers. You said there was two identical Dodge Challengers, correct?
Yep.
Okay, did you know they weren't exactly identical? There was one thing different. Do you know what that is?
No, there were several things different, not the same car. There were two dark stripes on it. There were the rain sensors, the tinted windows were different, and so on. So not the same vehicle.
How about the sunroof?
The sunroof was missing as well, even though it's in the registration papers, but also you have the around the headlights on the car that is going into the crowd, they're silver aluminum colored around the headlights, but the car that was later found when he was arrested has the same color as the car, and it's not the identical color of the car either. So there's at least two different vehicles involved here.
And you asked me a question, you know, how can this be and why would they do it? I can tell you why. I can tell you why they leave clues. Because they are brazen and they're boastful. And by the way, there's something called spread betting. Have you ever heard of spread betting in these? Okay. What they do is some evil people in the United Kingdom. And by the way, I want to back up and say the vast majority of the people in the United Kingdom have no idea what these evil people are doing. But for over 200 years, they've bet on catastrophes where a bunch of very wealthy and evil people bet money. In the case of the Charlottesville, they could have bet how many people will be killed or how many will be injured, and they would give a range, and people could lay money down. Like I could lay down $2 million. I think they're going to kill one and injure 12 or whatever. And then as soon as all the bets are covered, they let it happen, and then whoever's got the correct answer, he scoops the pot. That's how evil these people are, and I didn't just make that up. There's a lot of history to prove what I just said. But
I can tell you, if you bet on the Freemasonic numbers, you will have a very good chance of winning.
Yeah, that's where 11-11 comes in. You know, we had 9-11, and you had in Europe here you had 7-7. The Masonic numbers are one thing, but these evil people, they think they can't be caught because they truly think that we're all stupid, and they truly think that they're all smart. Well, they're not that smart. I mean, I myself played a part in resolving how Joe Kennedy Jr. died. I mean, that's one of the very few things. I'm not a researcher. I'm a public face and a spokesman. I stand in front of my organization that does the research. I want to correct you only because it was inadvertent. But when you were talking about the satellite company GVF that was tracking Malaysia 370, you inadvertently said Malaysia 340. And the only reason I bring that up is I think it's critical and crucial. I learned something from you right now. I learned several differences in those Dodge Challengers or Chargers, whichever. You told me that there were more than just the sunroof and the license plate. But I always want to be corrected if I misspeak. And I have a pretty aggressive chat room. And if I make a mistake talking on my own radio show, they'll tell me in the chat room field, you might want to try that again because you just...
I want to thank you for correcting me because I have not looked into these airline crashes so much. So thank you for correcting me. Can I just read from their website and then see if this makes any sense to you, this TVF?
Yeah, please do.
TVF stands for Global VSAT Forum. It says it's a single and unified voice of the global satellite industry. Founded in 1997, it brings together organizations engaged in the delivery of advanced broadband and narrowband satellite services to customers and commercial and government enterprises worldwide. Headquartered in London, DVF is an independent, non-partisan and non-profit organization with 230 plus members from more than 100 countries.
Well, have you ever heard of off-book accounting?
No.
Okay, it's when you got two sets of books. So GVF would have one set of books where their accountants take meticulous effort to keep the books absolutely accurate and legal. Okay, that's the official books. Now you got the off-book accounting. So the same corporation, I'm not saying they do. I'm saying it's possible. These same people that run GVF in London, they could be doing everything correctly at the GVF offices, and then some of the senior people with money behind them could be going down to the Whites Club, which I think was where a lot of the spread betting has taken place historically, and they could lay $1 million on numbers. And like you said, the odds are better if you lay them on Masonic numbers. But see, the Masonic people and the evil people, they're so boastful and so egotistical they want to get credit for the evil they're doing. So they leave little tidbits so that people can come along later and figure this out. But see, that works both ways. On the morning of 9/11, there was a very, very significant signal that was sent, but only to people who had a combination of, well, biblical knowledge and aviation experience. Because nobody else, if you didn't have that combination, you wouldn't be able to recognize the signal. But I'm, for the, not for you, but for your crowd, I'm going to hold up four fingers. On the morning of 9/11, there were four E-4B doomsday machines, flying command posts, that were operated by FEMA, F-E-M-A, and actually at that point they might have been operated still by the U.S. Air Force, but I think they were operated by FEMA, F-E-M-A, Federal Emergency Management Agency. That's not true. They don't manage emergencies, they create them. It goes back to the Clinton family and the Bush family. But anyway, there's four of these very complex 747s that are stationed at Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. It's in a little town called Bellevue, Nebraska, which is right outside Omaha, which is where Warren Buffett operates. Now, Warren Buffett, on the morning of 9/11, had 300 Goldman Sachs bankers from New York City. They were out of New York City, and they were in Omaha at the former command post of the Strategic Air Command, and they were in a below-ground bunker watching the carnage. In real, these guys are evil voyeurs. They created 9/11, and then they wanted to watch people die. Okay, but let's get back to the E-4Bs and the clue. On the morning of 9/11, three E-4B aircraft were airborne, which has historically never happened before. However, there were flight plans. When you want to fly an airplane, commercial or military or private, if you're going to operate in the instrument environment, you have to have a flight plan. Okay, so any logical person, including you, I gave you one question already, and you did a wonderful job of answering it about full authority digital engine control. And I'll just tell you, I will never ask you as the host a question you can't answer, because I think that's unfair. And I think it's also childish. But on the morning of 9/11, there were four call signs with flight plans, but there were only three airplanes. And I'll just to demonstrate that I can remember minute details, I don't know why, but the four E-4B call signs on 9/11 were Venus 77, Vivi, V-I-V-I, 36, Word, W-O-R-D, 31, and Sword, S-W-O-R-D, 31. That was a clue because, and you can find this, if you search like call signs of E-4Bs on 9/11, you'll find all four call signs, but the two that are significant are Word and Sword 31, because that's a direct quote, and I'm not a biblical scholar, but I think it's Ephesians 10:17, where in that small piece of scripture, it says, the sword of truth, which is the word of God. Now that makes your skin crawl. Somebody who loved America and loved people and hated evil left a huge, huge clue, because that person filed two flight plans. One of them said Sword 31 and one of them said Word 31. And that man or woman, whoever they were, I'm sure they were hoping and praying that someday somebody would see the significance. And I do see the significance. And the people that did 9/11, first of all, they have an eternal punishment coming if they don't turn away. They can turn away and acknowledge what they did, but they think they can't do that because a lot of them are pedophiles and there's videotape of them in pedophile acts. And they also think, like in the, I'm sure my sister, Christine Marcy, she thinks that if she were to come over to my side and turn away from evil, that she would be killed by her co-conspirators. Well, one of her closest co-conspirators is Hillary Clinton. And if anybody's ever studied the Clinton family for more than 3 nanoseconds, their enemies end up dead.
There's a long, long body count behind them.
Yes, and it's getting longer every day. But, you know, they can't kill everybody.
No. And let me ask you, when we're still on 9/11 here, what made the hole in Shanksville? What made the hole in the ground?
Yes. Have you ever seen the very first pictures of the hole in the ground when there's a horizontal line and a vertical line that's been burned in the sand or the dirt? Have you ever seen that picture?
No.
Okay. The tail end of an airplane, in this case, it was a 757. If you can look at an aircraft going away from you, you see a horizontal stabilizer, which is the small wing in the back, and you see a vertical stabilizer, which everybody calls a tail. You got a horizontal, and then you got a vertical, and that's exactly what was in the sand at the site of the impact of what remained, and I'm going to say that again, of what remained of United 93. Let me tell you how that happened. All of these 9/11 airliners, meaning the real airliners with the real passengers, they all had a French insulation. It looks like insulation, but it's rocket fuel. I'll give you the name of the corporation. They're publicly being, they probably don't like this. I don't care. I don't like murder. Smacksonic, that's the name of the industry in France that makes this. It looks like aviation insulation. It's trilaminar. That means three layers. And it's two color. The outside layers are both white and the inside layer is black. What that black stuff is rocket propellant or rocket fuel, solid rocket fuel. And when it's ignited, it goes from ambient temperature. And I don't like talking like a snobbish college boy. And I'm not. I'm not snobbish and I'm not a college boy. But sometimes, because I have command of these words, people think, oh, he's pretty impressed with his education. No, I'm not. I'm not impressed at all.
So why on earth would they have rocket propellant there?
To get rid of the evidence. What they did in the case of all these airliners, the three that went to Whiskey 386 Alpha Airspace and United 93 that was too late to attack the Capitol, they remotely detonated them. Okay, I'm going to find something that looks... Well, I found something, but it's full of water. I'm going to get a cylinder here, and this is the fuselage of an aircraft, okay? Now, a jet aircraft takes off at the elevation of the airport, and they climb typically to 33 to 39,000 feet. And the ambient pressure is less and less the higher you go, so they have to pressurize the inside of the aircraft to keep the cabin altitude below 10,000 feet. And for these modern Airbuses and the more modern Boeings and everything built by Embraer, Bombardier, and Sukhoi, they keep the cabin altitude around 7,000 to 8,000 feet so that they don't have to give the passengers supplemental oxygen. Okay, and they do that by pressurizing the cabin using bleed air. I don't want to get into the technology. It's quite simple. In a car or a truck, you have an air conditioner, same thing in an airplane, but what they do besides changing the temperature and the humidity of the air in an airplane, because it's a closed vessel, it changes the pressure. And they modulate the pressure by electrically operated outflow valves that slowly move to relieve pressure in the aircraft. But on 9/11, now, I'm going to give you the front end of this airplane. That's the cylinder of a fuselage. All around the fuselage, up in the, where the crew is, the cockpit, and back in the cabin where the passenger and flight attendants are, in addition to the cabin pressure and the air conditioning, they have insulation. And the insulation that's all around 360 degrees of the fuselage, at least where humans are, has insulation that is sound, thermal, and vibrational insulation. Okay, well, on 9/11, they took the aircraft that were going to be used on 9/11, and they stripped out the real insulation, and they put Smacksonic, which looks like insulation, in there. And then I'm going to get three sheets of paper. I wish I, if I ever did this professionally, I would get some graphics I could hold up. But here's three sheets. Everybody at your radio show is going to see three sheets. This and this are white, and they look like real insulation. The one in the middle, this one, is black, and it's rocket fuel. Okay, when you remotely trigger an electronic arc across this trilaminar insulation, it detonates the rocket fuel, the black stuff, and I'm going to give you some pretty accurate numbers right now, and you're going to be amazed or sickened by this. But in less than a second, the temperature goes from ambient, ambient means normal or whatever is existing, and typically in an airliner, it'd be 73 to 75 degrees. It goes from 74 degrees to 5,800 degrees in less than a second. And that, okay, yes, okay, you're wincing already, but for those who are not quite as quick as you, it's not just the heat, it's the pressure. You asked me what marked the sand at the Shanksville. Here's the fuselage, and here's the side view of the fuselage, and I told you the pressure is maintained by outflow valves. There's also emergency outflow valves. If the normal outflow valves fail, and the aircraft is going to suffer an overpressure, which would warp the fuselage, then there's a blowout valve which will reduce or ameliorate the overpressure condition. Well, not when it goes from 74 to 5,800, the overpressure is going to be severe. The weakest part of the cabin of the aircraft, doesn't matter whose, is at the rear of the aircraft. Here's the nose, here's the tail, and right where the passenger compartment stops, and the empennage is a French word for the tail, the horizontal vertical stabilizer, they stop the pressure right there. Well, if you introduce a 5,800 degree temperature rise, it's going to find the easiest way out of the airplane, which is going to be the rear pressure bulkhead. It's going to blow the tail off. Now this portion of the fuselage is open. So all that overpressurized hot air, it's going to turn what's left of the aircraft into a rocket, because equal and opposite forces. As the hot air tries to go that way, it's going to push what's left of the aircraft that way. That's sort of a long story about how that mark got in the sand. The vast majority of the aircraft was destroyed. 5,800 degrees is enough to turn anything into plasma. I'm not a scientist, but plasma is the lowest reducible form of matter. And almost all of the aircraft was destroyed, so there's no evidence. There's no people. There weren't any seats. There was fabric from the seats that went down into the lake. There's no sheet metal. The only two things that I know that were left of the aircraft was one of the engines got ripped off, and it was found 7 or 8 miles from Shanksville impact site. The empennage, in other words, the horizontal and the vertical stabilizers, that got blown off, okay? Now it was influenced by the heat very briefly, and it got superheated on the leading edge of what's left. Then it fell because it was blown away from the aircraft. The aircraft went that way really quickly, and the tail just sort of fluttered down, and it cooled off. But keep in mind, in fact, I was going to ask you a question. I don't want to do that. That's not fair. But many of your listeners might know what the altitude of that aircraft was when it was destroyed. And the answer is it was very, very low. It's flying inverted upside down at treetop level. Well, if you're at treetop level, maybe you're 100, 200 feet above the ground. If something's superheated and it's going to fall 200 feet, it's not going to cool off dramatically in 200 feet. It's going to burn an imprint in the sand or dirt. And then that's what happened. It left an imprint before it consumed itself due to the heat. And that's why there's very few pictures of the initial impact of whatever remained of the aircraft. And let me give you another detail that's not necessarily significant. But immediately after that event, the Pennsylvania National Guard was ordered by their governor, whose name was Tom Ridge, to go out and secure the crash site. Now, what secure means to me and you and your listeners is make sure that all the evidence is left there. But that's not what secure the crash site means to the government. It means if there's anything identifiable, get it out of there before the press finds it. You probably haven't heard the name Tom Ridge, but Tom Ridge, who did what he was told on 9/11, probably believing he was on the right side, he was given a giant reward from G.W. Bush. He was given control. Tom Ridge was the first administrator of DHS, Department of Homeland Security, I think. That's my opinion. And everyone out there listening to you when this is played will search engine that, and they'll find it to be true. I'm confident. But anyway, because he played a big role in covering up the truth of 9/11, he was given a prestigious job. Now, am I suggesting he's a bad guy? No, the opposite, because he didn't stay in that job very long. I think he figured out how he'd been used. He became remorseful that he was used in covering up a crime against humanity, and he refused to participate. So he broke out of the federal government, and he hasn't been seen since. But he did the right thing. There was a Canadian general who was involved in 9/11 whose name was Maurice, M-A-U-R-I-C-E, Baril, B-A-R-I-L. He was involved unwittingly. He didn't know what he was doing, but he was in a significant position of power on 9/11, and he did get remorseful. And I know that because he was given a cush job in the aerospace industry in Canada. And once he figured out how he'd been used, he couldn't stand it. So he left that job because he was not going, just like Tom Ridge, they were not going to be rewarded for covering up mass murder with about 3,000 people on that day alone that resulted in three wars that have killed millions of people based on 9/11. Because the bottom line of 9/11 is the Muslims had nothing to do with it. They were simply patsies. That's my short answer.
That was a fantastic answer. And we come to the end of this interview, Teal. I hope it's not the last time. I would very much like to learn a lot more from you. And but before we end, can you please tell people how they can get in touch with you, how we can support you in your efforts, and anything else you would like to add?
Okay, well, my email address is field, F-I-E-L-D-M-C-C, at yahoo.com. And I get lots of emails every day, and I have to use discernment, but when I get good questions, I give good answers. And oftentimes, if I get a good question, I will use that question in my next radio show, and I'll answer it so everybody gets the answer. So my name is Field McConnell. I gave you my email address, F-I-E-L-D-M-C-C at yahoo.com. Our key website is Able, A-B-E-L, Danger, D-A-N-G-E-R, abledanger.org. We have a radio archive of about 575 radio shows we've done out of my little town in Wisconsin, a population 600. We also have probably 1,000 YouTubes out there. And if anybody, just to centralize it, it's not, first of all, I'd rather go fishing. I'd like to be retired. I want to unwind, but that's not likely to happen. So I'm sort of a focus point, and I will put anybody in touch that wants to see our YouTubes. There's close to 1,000 of them. We have a YouTube archivist in Phoenix, Arizona. As far as supporting us, you know, that's the way a lot of otherwise good people get misled, is because money and power are very intoxicating, and we all need money. But as far as financial support, Able Danger doesn't accept any, because we want to work for who we work for, which is the global commoner, and we want to work for good, opposing evil. But if people, so for people that have an element of faith, there's one thing they can do. For people that don't believe in any spiritual truth, that's okay. What they can do is they can forward our links via Twitter and other social media. They can take links of our YouTubes and share them with their friends. I believe, it's not just me and you, but I'm saying this for other reasons. In the last week, I've seen a little spark turning into a raging fire, and I think the truth is now uncontainable. I don't think the bad people I think they know they can't stop us, the truth tellers, and they could stop me. I mean, I'm sitting right here in an unprotected building near Farnborough Airport in the United Kingdom. They could haul me away and kill me. It wouldn't slow down the train. This train has left the station, and it's going down a very steep slope. It's got oil and grease on the tracks, and you're not going to stop the truth. But for those people who have faith in some power higher than mankind, I say if you really want to help support our mission to protect the global commoners that are being oppressed in every country of the world, I'd say, you know, don't pray for me, Field McConnell. I get plenty of prayers. I mean, more is always welcome. But for those people who believe in the power of prayer, if they would pray for the mission of Able Danger and the mission of your radio exposure, and I know you have conferences that you attend, like in Czechoslovakia, I'll leave with this on a very positive note. I truly expect something of world-changing proportion to happen in the next 30 days. And if it does happen, you will get an email from me inviting you to Texas to speak, where we're going to have international speakers who all understand, if nothing else, we've been lied to and it's killing millions of people. Over to you.
Here, I can say here now, thank you so much for the invitation, and I would so like to come there and share a cold beer with you and salute each other and celebrate that we have transcended this bump in the road called the New World Order. Until then, I'm also super positive. People have said, but how can you say things like that? How can you be so positive? The thing is, my mind might say that this is impossible to get out of, but my heart knows for sure that this is not going to be any problem. We just need to focus on the truth and nonviolence, and then just be fearless in the exposure.
Yeah, one of their two biggest weapons is fear, and I reject that. I'm not afraid of them. I'm not afraid of anybody. I'm afraid of falling short of what I'm asked to do by a higher power, and that's expose evil. So that's what I do. Thank you very much for inviting me today. I hope you're not disappointed, and I'm sorry that sometimes I rattle on, but it's sort of like the fuselage of that aircraft. I'm overpressurized with facts that I've learned, and I don't like what I talk about, especially the pedophilia. But, you know, I don't like talking about it, but somebody needs to. And in some cases, that somebody may be me or maybe you.
With that said, I thank you so much, and your wife as well. I'm very sorry that she has to go through problems, but that is part of the journey. This time on Earth, it's a bit of a boot camp that, like you would like to go fishing. I would like to go sit, play my guitar or whatever. But this is needed to be done.
Well, we'll get it done.
We will indeed. Thank you so much, Field, and I hope to see you very soon.
I hope to see you very soon, too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for listening to Light on Conspiracies, the place where truth and love transcend the darkness. Take care and see you soon.